Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Amy McGuire, co-host, how are you?
Yes, pretty good this morning, Tiger. How are you?
Very good. I'm good. It's not so cold.
I've still got a big jacket on. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Me too. I threw it on. Don't you worry. Now, our guest today, Amy, is Professor Ted Wilkes, talking to us from WA, I believe, Perth. Ted, welcome to the program, brother. How are you?
Good, thanks, Tiger. And, good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Tell us your mob, your country, brother.
Beg your pardon?
Tell us your mob, your country.
Oh, we're still doing okay. We, as we all do, we have our little bits of quarrels here and there, but we're moving along pretty well at the moment. We know what we want.
All right. Who is your mob? When? Where your country is?
Yeah, my country is the Noongar Boodja. I'm a Whadjuk Noongar man. Us Whadjuk Noongars are the people that live around Perth, so we have ancestral pathways back to Perth. And this country we call the Dirbal Yerrigan, which is the Swan River. But the Noongar people have about 12, maybe 13. There's one tribe we're still trying to work out, but about 12 to 13 tribes amongst the Noongar people, and we are the people that, we're the custodians of the lands that are run from Geraldton across towards Kalgoorlie and down to the south coast near Esperance. So it's a pretty big block of land, and we've just completed a deal with the government over here about native title. So we're looking forward to start building a good quality of life for our mob.
All right. Now, it's fantastic to be able to talk to you in your capacity as Professor Ted Wilkes and the interest in health. And you're on the National Council still?
Health? Yeah, there's a... When the Liberal Party got in, they disbanded the old system, which was the Australian National Council on Drugs and the National Indigenous Drug and Alcohol Committee, and they've set up what they call the ANACAD, which is the Australian National Advisory Council on Alcohol and Drugs, and I'm an advisor on that committee. I'm called a principal Aboriginal advisor, but I've already put it to them that I wasn't happy that NIDAC got closed down and that I need to have other Aboriginal people on this committee with me. It's a difficult job when we travel on our own to try and advise governments. So
you're the only Aboriginal rep on that council at the moment?
Yeah, I am, unfortunately. Wow. I have asked that we try and get a woman onto the committee. I think it's important that we have a female and a male person operating at that level. So hopefully they'll bring that about in the next little while, I suppose.
When I say, Ted, it's fantastic to talk to you in this capacity, I mean, we go back many, many years, long before maybe you were thinking about continuing your education, and here we are. It used to be Brother Ted, now it's Professor Ted. I mean, that's what I mean when I say it's fantastic to talk to you in this capacity. It's really good to see.
Thank you, Tiger. Yeah, we do go back a ways. And in fact, your mum and I were good friends, and when she used to do her stories over, I used to dress up in my culture and sit down with a little spotlight on me as a younger man and play the didgeridoo and do those Aboriginal things that we like to do together. So I do have a strong connection to your family.
Most certainly do, and it's good to maintain that connection and be able to get you on the program and talk about such important issues as health, mate. And Amy's got a few questions here that she'll start off with.
Yeah, well, I mean, earlier this month, I think it was, there's been a parliamentary inquiry looking specifically at alcohol use and how it affects Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities around the country.
Yep.
Sadly, it hasn't been reported a lot. This is the fact that we're still talking about this. Do you have any confidence that the recommendations in this inquiry will actually be taken on board, given we seem to always be talking about alcohol abuse and how it harms our communities?
No, I've got to say the movement of action within the policy settings of Australia are still pretty withdrawn and very slow. So I don't have any any immediate confidence, but we've managed to slowly but surely impress on governments that alcohol is the cause and effect of many of our social dilemmas. And not only our social dilemmas, but our dilemmas when we go into a hospital, so the medical issues that are associated with the body. If you've been consuming alcohol in large quantities or over a period of time for a long time, it does impact on the metabolism in the body. And we need to make sure that not only our community, but all of those service deliveries, the AMSs and all of the alcohol and drug services, are kept up to date with new information about how alcohol and drugs impacts on our bodies and our spirit and our social world. So there's a long way to go, but there's a lot more information available to governments now, and I can say to you seriously that it's great with all the young Aboriginal people coming through as doctors, as nurses, as health workers, as lawyers, because we're able to increase and intensify our lobby and our desire for a better quality of life. And if we want that, we've got to actually fix up all of the issues that are associated with alcohol and drugs.
You mentioned before about governments and politicians not particularly taking it as seriously as they should be. I mean, how much do current policies sort of counteract the good work that people like you and a lot of other Aboriginal people are doing? I mentioned in the inquiry it talked a lot about mandatory alcohol treatment in the Northern Territory, which has been criticised for criminalising public drunkenness. And that's something that you've actually researched a bit before. I mean, can you tell us a bit about the mandatory alcohol treatment scheme in the Territory and the concerns that you might have about it?
Yeah. The Northern Territory's Act was introduced in 2013, so it's been going for a couple of years now, and it's the only state or territory in our country that allows for the civil commitment of people. So, as you say, they get apprehended for drinking in public, and if they get apprehended for drinking in public three times in 2 months, they're referred into this alcohol mandatory scheme. So they're then obliged to go through a mandatory rehabilitation for up to 3 months. So that's the first point I'd like to make. And the second is that most of the patients, or most of the clients, 99% of the patients treated through the scheme are Aboriginal. So that says something to me that this has basically been set up to try and deal with the eyesore that exists when white fellows see Aboriginal people sitting in the parks and walking around town, seemingly inebriated. And so the police have been given the power to pick these people up and take them out of sight, and somewhat out of mind, I think, too. So we who work in public health would maintain that this isn't a good scheme. We maintain that there are better ways to deal with Aboriginal people who have alcohol issues, alcohol and drug issues, and these can be done through our community-controlled organisations. And, you know, these are medical issues, these are health issues, so we maintain that these should be dealt with through the health system rather than through the justice systems.
Do you ever think there's ever been a good explanation given by the NT government about why it has to be mandatory rather than voluntary?
No, they haven't. There's no evidence that this intervention works. So, you know, well, particularly in relation to drinking behaviours in the long term, it might have a short term impact. But the only information that the governments give out, or the Northern Territory give out, are short sort of stories. They have what they call their success stories. But at the end of the day, there's no evidence that the follow up treatment in the long term for people who come out of these regimes are being looked after properly, and I can only presume or assume that there's probably a fair bit of relapse, or there are a lot of people doing it hard, you know.
And one of the problems is when they relapse, there's no data or transparency around the numbers surrounding that, is there?
No, there's not a lot, and that's what we need to do in relation to data and collecting information to make sure that we've got a good eye on the ball, and we can talk about the strengths and weaknesses of these sorts of programs. It seems to me that there are more weaknesses in it. But it actually costs $27 million a year to run this program, and I've got some stats down in front of me. That's why I'm talking solid here. So there were 418 people referred between July 13 and July July 14. And it's costing us $64,000 per person.
Wow.
So we could do a lot better with that money. If we were to invest that in good drug rehabilitation and treatment services for our mob, that'd be a better way for us to go.
It really does point to what you were saying before, that this is largely to deal with blackfellas on the streets rather than actually helping them rehabilitate, doesn't it? When you look
at expenses
like that.
It speaks of what we call urban amenity. And, you know, as I said before, when the mainstream population look at Aboriginal people in towns like Darwin and the Territory, and there are many towns in the West, and I'm sure there are towns in Brisbane where our mob are quite visible, and look, like all citizens of Australia, we have a right to access alcohol. It's a legal substance. And we know that mainstream people, watchula people I call them, with no offence, so they're able to access alcohol, and because of their life circumstance, they're able to either do this in clubs, in pubs, or at home, or in certain parks or camping areas, whereas our people are somewhat shut away from accessing public spaces to go and consume alcohol.
Ted, when you say $60,000 per person is what the cost is with this with treatment or rehabilitation, you also said there's better ways that we can spend this money. Any ideas? What's coming from the community? What are you seeing or hearing out there? I mean, for example, June Oscar up in up Fitzroy Way has had some great success. To my understanding, I don't know a lot. I haven't seen a lot of information. But what do you see are better ways? How can we best spend that sort of money and get better results, outcomes?
Well, I think if we invest in the knowledge at the local level, we can make statements at the national and the state levels. But at the end of the day, it's really up to the local people to want to put in place proper programs to look after one another. And we have to depend on the Aboriginal leadership at the local level, but not only the Aboriginal leadership, we need a buy-in from non-Aboriginal service deliveries and non-Aboriginal people, experts and supporters, because this is about looking at the social construct of our communities. And we know some of the interventions around alcohol consumption are to do with the social determinants. So if people had jobs, for instance, so if governments and the private enterprise were encouraged to employ and put in place training schemes for our people to get jobs and employment, then that gives them a bit of status and self-esteem, and we know that that's a good intervention. It takes people away from alcohol and drugs during the day. People usually get home in the evenings and they might have a couple of beers, but they're too buggered to go out and binge drink. So we know that employment is a good intervention. We know that education in the longer term is also a good intervention. If we get the knowledge out there to our people about what harm alcohol and drugs does to us, we can then all start to make informed decisions. But at the local level, it's important that local community people are involved in making the bylaws or the laws that govern the distribution and the consumption of alcohol and other drugs. So Australia has a policy based on harm minimisation. So we're not saying you've got to stop. We're saying that some people might have to stop. They might have to abstain because it's hurting them too much. And if they are truly addicted, we need them to be advised that, yep, they need treatment and rehabilitation, and we would want to take them into our organisations or into our places and heal them people, heal their spirits, heal them physically, and get them prepared to have another crack at life. There are, there are lots of complex issues. This isn't this isn't something I'm making it, not trying to make it sound simple. It's very complex, and we know that some drugs are different than others. But alcohol, in particular, is a legal substance. There are systems in place where we can treat these people, but we don't have access to some of these, and we have to travel long distances sometimes to get to these places. So we need more. We need to fill in the gaps, the physical gaps, the geographical gaps that exist, so that we can allow these people to get good access to good services.
Yeah, and I get what you mean about the complexity, because I think even in Alice Springs, alcohol policy is just so, in a way, political, but also a bit very contested. For example, the unit that runs the mandatory alcohol treatment is an Aboriginal run unit. So there's obviously quite a lot of frustration amongst local Aboriginal leaders about the best way to deal with alcohol, isn't there, particularly in Alice Springs, given the extent of the problem?
Yeah, yeah. There have been many attempts to do things, and some of them are good, some of them are punitive. Some places where Aboriginal people have an input into it, we can restrict the number of outlets in our communities. We can play with the price. We can manipulate the price, because if you put the price up, people don't have enough income to keep buying alcohol, and so price does impact on it. We can restrict the hours of delivery, and that's up to the local communities. If they think that people are getting too much access to alcohol outlets, they can. We would like to think Aboriginal leaders would be able to influence governments to restrict the times of sales. But, you know, there are all sorts of legal complications, because we as Aboriginal people are citizens of this country, and everyone else has rules that govern access to alcohol and the times it can be sold. And, you know, nightclubs are open and shut at certain hours of the night for all of us. So we Aboriginal people don't want to be necessarily treated unfairly or differently, but we do need to have some buy-in so that we can look after ourselves by having an input into some of those interventions that I just talked about.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think particularly when you look at the differences between the way Australians look at alcohol, for example, in the intervention when they wanted to just put blanket alcohol restrictions but changed it, for example, so tourists could drink at Uluru, we see the inconsistency there. Is White Australia ready to deal with its own alcohol problem? Is that a problem as well, the fact that drinking is an Australian pastime?
Well, you're right, you know, and we need to make sure that non-Aboriginal people understand that this isn't just about Aboriginal Australians. We know that we see people get quite aggressive on drugs, and when you're quite drunk, it can be a sad and sorry tale the next morning when you wake up if you've violated anyone else's place or if you've driven when you're drunk. And not to say that, you know, I do know that the drinking rates per capita in the territory are the highest in the land. And if you took out the Aboriginal population of the territory, the drinking rates within the territory would still be the highest. So,
well,
non-Aboriginal people and Aboriginal people in the territory are our highest drinkers. So we've got to somehow inform the territory people that, yeah, that's not a good tag to hold, I suppose. But we're working on it, and there are some really, really good public health people and practitioners in the territory, as there are in all of our states, that just need the chance to impact on the policy of governments and make sure governments start carrying through.
One of the recommendations of the inquiry was a minimum floor price for alcohol, which has been called for consistently, particularly in the territory. Is that something that you would back as well? Do you think it would be effective?
Yeah, if you did have a floor price, that is a minimum price for alcohol, it means that people can't get away with buying cheap full alcohol content beer or liquor or wine. So it would be sold at a rate in accordance with the content of the alcohol in it, and so at the moment, big supermarkets are able to sell cheap forms of alcohol. And obviously, if you know, all you want is a drink, and you want to escape from some of the pressures of the fact that you haven't got a job, and you're walking around town, or you feel as though you're being frowned on by the human beings, you'll go and buy the cheapest forms of alcohol, and you'll medicate using that cheap alcohol, and you'll get plastered, and then you get yourself into trouble with family, you get yourself into trouble with the law, and you could quite likely, if you're in the territory, end up in one of these mandatory rehabilitation centres if you're caught three times. And so, yeah, there are complications around what you as an individual do, but, you know, we know that Aboriginal people throughout Australia use alcohol. Well, I've maintained that we use alcohol for mainly two reasons. One is to medicate. Some of us need it to just escape from the pressures of the everyday lifestyles that we live. And the other is to recreate. So, as with other human beings, and it's sold in throughout Australia, so we can take a bit of alcohol with us and get that high that alcohol gives us and have a good time, socialise with friends and family, use it over a meal. You know, so those are the two main reasons. And unfortunately, yeah, you know, a lot of our people binge drink. They use it to medicate, and inevitably they probably get to be a little bit unhealthy, or even more unhealthy than they would want.
Ted, there's a real criminalisation of our mob taking place with these policies and legislation and stuff, which is not good. But one of these things that's causing a bit of discussion and controversy is, in the Northern Territory, the Banned Drinkers Register. What are your thoughts on that? Because it appears that the Northern Territory government is resisting, that they introduced it, then abolished it, and there's some pressure on. I mean, what are your thoughts on something like that, a Banned Drinkers Register?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I haven't really thought about it, Tiger, but I have thought about the Banned Registers Drink Act in the past, and I remember in the old days, particularly back when I was watching my dad and my mum, and there used to be these pubs, and the publican had the right to ban someone from the pub if you played up or if you did anything silly. There's some merit in it to have a system, and again, I would ask that the Aboriginal leaders or the Aboriginal communities where this might impact on people have input and a control over how we frame the laws around a banned drinker. Who is a banned drinker and why do you become a banned drinker? And if the community are able to control that, well, then I'm sure that if you or me were banned by our community because we did something silly the night before, we'd feel pretty sheepish and we'd probably have to accept our punishment. And if that meant we were banned from going into a hotel or drinking alcohol or buying alcohol for a certain period of time, well, you know, when your mob say that to you, there's a difference in that. But if the law, the white law systems or the government law systems say that to you, you might not feel the same. So there are ways to put these things in place. But the Banned Drinkers Register probably did have some good impact. It allowed people to take control. It identified people who were not consuming or using alcohol with the proper respect for the law. And again, if we were able to evaluate those sorts of programs, we would be able to say, yeah, these things work. And I'm not sure whether we've done a proper evaluation of the Banned Drinkers Register, but there are some positives in it that I saw when I was looking at it.
It's fair enough to be banned from acquiring or purchasing alcohol, but you can always sit around in a circle with the rallies, the Kazis, the brothers, whoever, and still have a drink. So it's sort of, has a bit of an impact one way, but then the other way is it's still sort of available.
Yeah, and if you are one of the banned drinkers and others are able to give you alcohol, and if you play up again, it might be that the circumstance would have to be assessed again. But usually, look, most people in our communities know who we are, and we know who are the ones that are carrying a bit of stress and are carrying a bit of a mental health issue, and if they do drink alcohol or consume drugs, you know, there's a thing called the comorbidity of alcohol and mental health. And if you've got a little bit of a depressed lifestyle where you're depressed or you're anxious or you're upset, you're uptight, and you take alcohol on top of that, you're more vulnerable than someone who is going to grab the guitar and sing some songs because they're happy and they just want to relax. So, yeah, sometimes it's things that we can't see. We can't see inside of another person's body and what they're carrying. But usually I would say if they're carrying those stresses and anxieties within the mob, and if the mob were able to assist that human being or that Aboriginal person, well, it's probably done better within the mob.
Yeah, it's got to be something that we can work on together. I mean, if the mob or community knows, is aware of a particular member of our community or family that's a banned drinker, well, we can get around and support, be in a position to be able to be more supportive, I imagine, you know, and work in with within the law, and but with our own mob and our own family ways and customs. But you mentioned sitting around, picking up a guitar, singing a song. It's a nice segue into a song that you wrote back in the 80s. Might have been earlier, No More Younger. Let's have a listen to it, and you can tell us a little about it. They got them all. That's Professor Ted Wilkes is my guest here, our guest this morning, and that's pre-Professor days, before the Professor. Tell us, brother, when did you write it, and that message is about the impact of colonisation on our mob.
Yeah, it is. It was one of my first songs. I've actually been a songwriter and singer for most of my life. Mum and Dad were singers, so we were singers, and we socialised around the kitchen table using a bit of alcohol, don't worry. And we would sing songs, and Mum in particular would say, let's make up a song about something. And the yonger in that song is the kangaroo. So our Noongar word for kangaroo is yonger. And when I say there's no more yonger, there's no more kangaroo. I used to live in the country, and we would go hunting. We would take the kangaroo dogs out, or we'd set the snares, or if there were men with guns, we would go out with the men with guns, and we would go hunting. And when I moved to Perth, that all changed. So we weren't able to go hunting, and we'd have to drive right out into the country to go to cousins, 100 or 200, maybe 300 k's out of Perth to go hunting for the kangaroo. So it was a way of saying, yeah, they've taken everything off of us. They've, you know, they got it all. They got the kangaroo. They've taken our land. They've taken our language. They tried to take our language. We're still building that back. They did other things to us, which I need not mention on radio, but the part of the colonising on the frontier was about, you know, the rape, pillage and plunder of Indigenous and what we call Winyan, or the societies that were vulnerable to people who had better technology or better warfare tactics. So they've taken it all off us, Tiger. That's all I was saying in that song. And in particular, I got up to Perth and I was missing the kangaroo meat, and Mum said, yeah, let's make up a song about the yonga. So that's where that song come from, and that was my young brother singing it with me. And yeah, I'm quite happy that it's become a song that others listen to and sing. So yeah, it's another way to keep your spirit intact, I suppose, by enjoying music.
Most certainly. You talk about sitting around, socialising with Mum and Dad and stuff, beer there. Is there an issue for our mob, our younger ones particularly, where they, not only with alcohol, the consumption of alcohol, but where it's sort of acceptable behaviour? It's something that happens on a daily basis or a regular basis. It's a bit like domestic violence. The young ones grow up watching the man of the house be the perpetrator of domestic violence, and it can go on for one or two generations and longer. Is this an issue, this acceptable behaviour business?
It is. It is an issue. We need to break the cycle, and we've used that term on many occasions where Australia in particular has become this cultural empire of alcohol consumption and the beer drinkers and the advertising of well-known brands of beer on the jumpers of our football players and etc. It's a culture which is dominated throughout Australia's mainstream population, and we Aboriginal people have sort of tagged onto it. And as I said, because we our social circumstances are so deprived and so disadvantaged, the evidence is that disadvantaged people and poor people consume alcohol mainly for that reason. Well, not mainly, but there are more people in the poorer parts of our community that would consume alcohol to try and use it as an escape mechanism from something that might be troubling them. So it's not to say they wouldn't drink, but they might drink just more. They might be consuming alcohol unknowingly to take away the pain of something which they're carrying with them.
You know, as we speak, we're talking about habits and acceptable behaviour. I've got a 5-year-old grandson, Yundakan. We call him Darkin. He's sitting on Stradbroke Island with his mother at the moment. He's taken the radio off his mother and he's listening in to pop on the radio.
Is he?
5-year-old. And this is a great habit. I mean, sure, they listen to their pop, but there are some subliminal message or messages that get through at this young age. And I just think it's amazing. I've got to say good morning to young Darkin and his brothers. I just think it's great that they take an interest. And maybe he's not too sure of what's going on, but he knows pop's on the radio and they're talking about alcohol. And I was fortunate where I didn't grow up with alcohol in the household. My dad I saw drunk probably 3 times until I left home at 15. So I was fortunate in that regard where I never ever drank a stubby of beer in my life because I had the first mouthful at 13, 14 and couldn't stand the taste of it. But and my children all growing up and have embraced that policy and those habits of not being drinkers and not having it in the household. And these young fellows like young Yundakan, a real young warrior that knows language, knows dance and song. He's a real young warrior. And to be hearing these sorts of messages and your music and your story there to that song, I think that's a great indication of the calibre of young people coming through and what they may become.
I'd like to say hello to your Darkin and your brothers and friends. And, yep, your pop is a pretty deadly man, this bloke. And you're right, Tiger, the role models for our children are us older people, particularly parents, and uncles and aunties and older brothers and sisters. We're all the role models for the young fellas coming through, and it does have a positive impact if we're living lifestyles that are positive. You know, there's a study of resilience in my background. I've studied resilience, and I've studied the vulnerable pathways and the resilient pathways. And the resilient pathways start off with a healthy pregnancy. And if we can get it right, to let mums and dads know that when you're having your child, you both are responsible for making sure that child in the womb is looked after. And that child outside the womb when it comes out is looked after. And we know that an intervention in early childhood is something which people like Fiona Stanley and others who I've worked with have come to the fore with to say, no, we need to make sure that 3-year-old kids get to feel good about themselves and to be able to get into the education system knowing that they're healthy, they've got a brain that's functioning well, and they can do it. And if we start off at that with those sorts of interventions or the other interventions that come in later, a lot easier to go through. So it's like the what we might call transitioning into an older human being. And we have to look after them until they're 18, apparently. But that's what we do as parents. And we are the role model. So our children will look up to us and they will base a lot of their adult life on how they saw it when they were coming through, when they were doing their their apprenticeship or so.
Mm-hmm. I've just been corrected by his mother. It's the big 2-year-old. He thinks he's 5-year-old, I think. It's a 2-year-old, Jungara. That's taken the portable radio off his mum, and he's sitting there listening to it. So, but no, it's just fantastic, young Jungi and his brothers and that home from school because they're crook, but they all go to kindy and daycare or whatever it is. That's probably a good segue into fetal alcohol syndrome and the issues with alcohol, the effects of alcohol while pregnant. It's a big issue for us. Has been for a long time, eh?
Yeah, it has. It's been a big issue for us. We've not known about it until the last couple of generations, and we're getting to know more and more about it now. We do know that there are other indigenous populations throughout the world that are impacted similar to us, that alcohol was became a part of their lives way back in history. And there's an intergenerational trauma about some of this stuff, that grandmothers who were grandmothers and granddads who didn't know about the poison impact that the alcohol would have on us in this way. We've now started to adjust some of the thinking and to say to our people, yep, this is so important for women and young men and young women in particular who are having children to understand that we're not allowed to drink when we're pregnant, and we're not allowed to consume drugs when we're pregnant. We need to make sure that this baby of ours is going to get a solid chance, and in fact it'll impact on your quality of life down the track, because if you've got a child that is smart, physically able to compete, you're going to be a lot prouder as a parent rather than someone who might have a diminished capacity, because alcohol does that to the brain. If the mother does consume alcohol during pregnancy, there runs a risk that the baby and the brain of that baby will be diminished. So they might not be able to be taught and to learn as quickly and as efficiently as other children. And they are the ones that we worry about ending up in the justice system.
There's a lot of myths around there around drinking alcohol when pregnant, isn't there? Some people say that just one drink's okay, you can have a couple. There's not a lot of information still about how alcohol affects babies, is there?
There's a lot more information today. You're right, there are some myths that one or two drinks doesn't hurt. And that's what it is, it's a myth. We don't have conclusive evidence at what stages of pregnancy it's worse than others, but we understand in the first trimester that if women are drinking in that first early developmental stage, that's pretty dangerous. We do know that things like breastfeeding after the baby's born, if the mother is breastfeeding and drinking at the same time, that's also not an advised way forward. So we do know that alcohol impacts on the brain, and we know that it impacts on the brain and drug-taking impacts on the brain. Your brain is actually growing until you're well and truly into your 20s. So it doesn't stop just with the fetus and being in the womb. It means that, young fellows who are coming through have got to be prevented from uptaking alcohol until they're into their 20s, when their brain's just about fully functional and fully grown. It concerns us that teenagers and young fellows are drinking at unhealthy levels, and it could still be impacting on the capacity of them to use their brains and to get their brain to function properly. So my advice is, if you want a healthy child, once you know that you're pregnant, the mum and dad, I would encourage to go away from alcohol, stop drinking alcohol until at least the baby's born and is well and truly starting to develop.
What about people who have a problem with alcohol who aren't able to stop, people who are already drinking to risky levels? What sort of support are in place to help them sort of wean themselves off alcohol while they're pregnant?
Yeah, unfortunately, in Australia, in Aboriginal Australia, there are some gaps here, and I've talked about the geographical gaps. Sometimes we don't have what we might call culturally appropriate service delivery for our people, and that's what I refer to the mob, that if we can get the mums and dads of these young fellas and the grannies and the support of aunties around to put in a family intervention and say to young mothers, come on, niece, come on, daughter, come on, young man, you've got to step up. It is true there are some of our young fellows don't like to toe the line, and they don't see the evidence as older people see the evidence. So it's important that us older people continue, without trying to nag, but continue to impress on young people that it's in all of our interest that we start to produce healthy Aboriginal people so we can play our proper part in society. And what we also need to do is look after those kids that are born with FASD. They're our babies. They're our children. They're not born to do anything wrong. They're impressionable. And so we need to make sure that we give them a life that they can live within the abilities that they've got. They're not ever going to be, astronauts or architects, some of them. But they still can play a meaningful role in our societies, you know.
Yeah, they are special, Ted, as you say, and it's important that we nurture and foster their growth and development, because who knows, they may surprise us. Some of them may That's become right. brain surgeons and what have you, because nothing surprises me. Their capacity to grow and develop is amazing, I think. But culture, Ted, cultural identity and using culture as our basis is something that we can all identify with and relate to. And I think that's probably one of the most important things when we develop a sense of hopelessness or wonder where to go. I think if we can just remember, look, culture, come back to culture. What are your thoughts? It's a vehicle for change or for nurturing, growing, developing. What are your thoughts?
Well, we know that our mob want culture, want cultural security in their lives. And we did a survey over in Western Australia with 5,000 kids and their families. And we asked the kids some important questions about what do they think is important. And most of those children said culture. And their mums and dads also said culture. So we still haven't got it right in the education system where our Aboriginal teachers, our grandmothers, our aunties, our dads, those fellows that are special hunters, we still need to make sure that our kids have incorporated in the education systems a respect for cultural learning. And we know that we've been wanting to bring back languages. We know that we've wanted to bring back the dance and the body painting right through now. You see it throughout the cities in the south. And it's fantastic to see that all our young kids are not ashamed to just jump up, chuck on a julep and body paint and then get someone to clap the sticks and someone to sing a song and away they go, you know. We didn't do that in our younger lives because we were made to feel shame about who we were. And it's only through the efforts of, you know, your mum, you, me, Amy and others to keep this fight going, to say, no, we've got nothing to be ashamed of. We are the first Australians. And it's happening in those places like Fitzroy Crossing that you mentioned, Tiger. You know, June Oscar, Emily Carter, the mums and the dads up there that have restricted the sale of full-strength alcohol and takeaway outlets in those places. They're worried about what's going on at home. They've put in place a system to understand fetal alcohol. They've identified some of the young fellas up there that are on the spectrum disorder. They're putting in place as interventions to make sure that those kids get as well-educated as we can possibly get them, and that the community also accept them within their community as somebody that's special, that they need to look after. And so culture and painting them boys up, fishing, taking them fishing, making them understand the noises of the birds and which bird this is, and, you know, the connection of the spiritual world to the elements like the wind and the sun and the rain, these are all things that you can make as a normal part of your day, but it's also learning and it's also building the capacity of these young fellows that might be a bit diminished to understand that they're loved and wanted, and they do have the capacity to take in the good things about life.
Is FASD classified as a disability?
Not yet. We're trying to get it to be classified as a disability, because it's certainly a brain injury, and through no fault of the people that are carrying this disability. But that's one of the fights that we need to keep on with, that we would impress on the governments of Australia that this is a disability and these young people need to be looked after.
Yeah, because you often hear about, you don't know how many people with Aboriginal kids with FASD or Aboriginal adults who end up in the criminal justice system because they just haven't been diagnosed or they haven't been pointed out this. So they're sort of just in prison, largely through no fault of their own because, you know, before they were born, they came down with this disability. They were, harboured with
You're
this
right
disability.
On. Yeah, and look, over in Perth here, we've had some researchers at our Telethon Kids Institute develop a new resource for justice professionals. And this new resource is particularly developed because we know that a lot of kids and a lot of young fellas and a lot of older fellas get put into jail and incarcerated in prisons and locked away because of crimes or silly things that they've done. As a result of that diminished capacity. And so we've developed this guide that is called Understanding FASD. It's a guide for justice professionals, and it's a guide for them to recognise potential FASD in young people who are engaged in the criminal justice system. So there are certain features that you can pick up, and there are certain behaviours that might just trigger a person sitting down on the bench who's having to make an assessment of a young person or another person's ability. And these things will help them to understand that maybe you've got someone here that's a FASD or a person on the spectrum. So, you know, there are certain things with the eyes, there are certain things with the upper lip, and there are certain behaviours. And so these are things which, if we can get these incorporated into our systems for the service deliverers to be able to understand and pick up FASD, well, then we think this will be a good thing.
And the thing I find really amazing is largely blackfellas are world leaders in trying to come up with solutions or ways to deal with FASD, aren't we? I mean, the rest of Australia really hasn't caught up with women like in Fitzroy Crossing and other parts of Australia who are really calling out for some sort of something to be done.
Well, as I said, you know, there are people in other parts of the world that are ahead of us in relation to understanding FASD. And in North America, for instance, in places like Canada and up in the north of the US, showed that there's research to show that young people with FASD are 19 times more likely to be incarcerated, and that 60% of the people with FASD over 12 years of age have been charged with or convicted of a criminal offence. So we're talking about, you know, high rates here of people with FASD in another country who are probably Indigenous, and you're talking about rates of 19 times more likely. That's on par with some of the jailing rates of our young fellows here in Indigenous Australia.
Yeah, and you just wonder particularly about Western Australia's jailing rates, whether if we were able to come up with whether magistrates or anyone else in the criminal justice system were able to divert kids with FASD away from, you know, bail and juvenile detention, whether we would lower those rates, how much of an impact it would actually have on those world-breaking jailing rates.
Well, that's it. And, you know, justice reinvestment, there are all sorts of ways to look at diminishing the need for prisons and incarceration. We, again, you know, the United States, we just recently heard President Obama talking about people who've been incarcerated for what people might call soft crimes. Okay, selling drugs is against the law, but should you be locked up for the rest of your life because you sold a couple of ounces of something? These are questions now that we're putting to the system because it costs a lot of money to incarcerate people. You know, you've, some time ago we did a survey or we did a study and we found that it's costing over $115,000 per person per year to put into a prison in Australia. Now, I would maintain that if you were to develop appropriate rehabilitation and treatment services with what I call that cultural respect, so that these places are culturally secure, many of these prisoners, many of these clients that go into the prison could be diverted to these places to get better treatment. So we can have an impact, but we need to get governments to start thinking about alternatives to prison. And I think a lot of us at the moment, I'm involved with a justice reinvestment group, which includes the Aboriginal Legal Services, the NACHO, and other significant organisations. And we're going to fight. We're going to fight to say, start reinvesting your money that you use for jails, put it back into the front end. Put it back into those interventions around the early years and giving young 5 to 10-year-old kids a chance to do good education, get good education.
And that's where it's at, Ted. We've got to pick up and pick it up at the community level, grassroots level, and take the initiative and hopefully force government into...
We do.
Mate, we're about out of time. Really appreciate you giving us your time, starting at 7 o'clock a.m. over the 7 a.m. In the West. Really appreciate it, brother, and great talking to you, eh?
All the best to both of you, and thank you for the chance to talk again, Tiger.
No worries, my brother. We will talk again too. You take it easy and continue on with the struggle, with the fight, the challenge.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you.
Cheers.
It's time to go, Amy.
Yeah, great chat though, Professor Ted Wilkes.
Certainly was. Join us tomorrow. Join Amy tomorrow for Let's Talk on your local First Nations station.